This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hello, this is Elizabeth Anderson. It is the second Saturday of the month, which means that it is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club. That is a 10th Voice show. And our guests today are author Ellen Hart, who wrote The Old Deep and Dark that we'll be discussing, Beth Burnett, who is in Michigan. We have Laura Sepperly, who is right here in the studio. Hi, Laura. And Linda Wilson, who's busy getting our two outside people on the line. She just did a wonderful woman song show for 2 hours, and she is our producer and sound engineer and book club member because she's always here on the board. She and Ellen talked, and Ellen picked the book for today, The Old Deep and Dark. Beth, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. So now we're going to get Ellen on the line and we'll be set to go. Beth, I understand that you have a book coming out, so you want to tell a little bit about it?
Absolutely. It's called Eating Life. It's a romantic comedy, and it's about a group of friends who have to go through the trials and tribulations of life and figure out what's most important to them.
When will it be out?
It's going to be out on August 15th. However, anyone that's going to the GCLS conference in July will have the chance to purchase it early.
The Golden Crown Literary Conference is which dates, and it's in Chicago?
Yes, ma'am. It is in Chicago, and it is July 5th through 9th. We're going to have so many incredible authors there giving master classes, panels, presentations, so it's going to be an incredible time.
I'm going to start by asking both you and Laura a preliminary question, and that is, what genre do you most like to read, and in the mystery genre, what subgenre do you most like to read? Beth, I'll start with you.
I have to be honest with you that my guilty little secret is I don't generally read mystery. And ever since I lived in the Virgin Islands and read John D. McDonald, the Travis McGee series, because it was pretty much the only thing I could find in the used bookstores there, Ellen's book is the first mystery I've read in probably a decade.
Well, good for us. And what genre do you read?
I love science fiction and romantic comedy, romance. I read a lot. I like Anne McMahon is one of my favorite authors. I also love Neil Gaiman, who does science fiction and fantasy.
I have seen him on your page several times, and I guess I'd better read him.
Yes, I highly recommend if you're going to start reading Neil Gaiman to start with the book Neverwhere.
Okay, just made a note of it. All right, and I'm now going to ask Laura the same question.
I started off with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and really got into Agatha Christie for a while, but my favorite subgenre right now is true crime.
And I noticed you mentioned in your bio the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of true crime you like to read about?
Yeah, I like where there's never been a really good answer and everything's cold and there's all kinds of conspiracy theories.
Interesting. I'll say that my genres are memoirs, historical fiction. Also, I do read some romances, and particularly for this book club, I'm trying to read all genres. For mysteries, my guilty pleasure is British cozies. I love to read about pubs and eccentric British people and village life.
This is Razy. Be
Beth,
alive.
Please stay put.
It's like a hurricane. An electric storm. It's like staying up all night just to see the dawn. It's like the smile of a child. It's like light on the water. It's like saying to my mother, yes, I'm proud to be your daughter. Yeah.
And Beth, do we still have you?
Yes, ma'am.
Ellen, while we were trying to get you on the line, I asked a question of both Laura and Beth, and I'm going to ask you, when you're not writing, what is your favorite genre to read, and what mystery subgenres do you read if you do?
Well, I love mysteries, and I like thrillers. I also am a real fan of true crime. That's something I actually read quite a lot of. So those would be subgenres. I also read a lot of nonfiction, so I read a lot. You couldn't tell.
A very good answer. And Laura, who's on the panel, joined you in true crime. She reads quite a bit
better.
Of that. And Linda, I haven't asked you. You were busy. So what do you read?
I read mysteries mostly written by women. I choose to read by women and because I want to support them. And I read a lot of mysteries. I read some autobiographies. I started 3 books this week and finished them, so I read a lot too, like Ellen does. It doesn't really matter. Mysteries are my first choice, but it really doesn't matter. I'll read just about anything.
I'm reading about 3 books a week. Ellen, I want to ask you how you started writing both this series, the Jane Lawless series, and the Sophie Greenway series.
Back in about the mid-80s, I knew I wanted to write something. And it never occurred to me that I should write a mystery, except that during that time, I read a book by a woman named Kate Green. She's a local poet here. And the book was kind of a breakout book for her, did really, really well. And I just thought it was fantastic. So I thought, well, maybe I should write a mystery, because I'd always loved mysteries. And then someone gave me a copy of Murder in the Collective by Barbara Wilson, and I think in a way that gave me permission not to have to write myself out of my book. And then I was watching TV at the time, the P.D. James Mysteries, the Dog Leash Mysteries on PBS, and they interviewed her after each episode for a few minutes, and they asked her the question. They said, you know, you're a fine writer, you could have written anything, why mysteries? And her answer intrigued me. She said, well, she said, I thought I'd write a mystery. It would teach me how to construct a novel. And then I'd move on to the real thing, which by that she meant literary novels. But she said, you know, I realized very early on that there was nothing that I wanted to say that I couldn't say within the context of a mystery, of a crime novel. And she said, I really loved working within the moral universe of that novel. And that really intrigued me because I have a degree in theology, and so those were issues that also compelled me and a lot of my reading. So I thought, well, maybe it should be a mystery. And so those things, 3 things together, kind of got me going.
And you must have a connection to food, too, because Jane Lawless owns a couple restaurants and Sophie Greenway owns a hotel.
Yeah. Well, when I started writing, I have a chefing degree, and I was working as a kitchen manager at a sorority at the University of Minnesota, which is why the first novel is actually set at a university sorority. So I stayed with that old maxim, you know, write what you know, and I did that for the first book. You very soon get past some of that, and you have to do some research. But so, yeah, I mean, that's where I started, and I just went on from there.
And you had me at Dalgleish. I don't know if you watched the Roy Marsden series, but I
loved those. Yeah.
Loved them. And Beth, let me ask you, you're from Michigan, upper Midwest. How important to you was it that this book was set in Minneapolis?
What I loved about it was that the characters they seemed really Minnesotan to me from the Minnesotans that I know. And especially there was a line where Ellen wrote, like a lot of Minnesotans, she was terminally casual. And I just thought that was so indicative of how many people I know from Minnesotans, a lot of lesbians I know from Minnesota say, in the wintertime, my gaydar goes off every single moment of every... And it was really quirky and cute, and I really enjoyed it.
I have to admit that the setting, if I'm looking for a book, the setting can grab me. And the fact that it was set in a theater was important. What about you, Linda?
It is important, and she does. I think she does grab the Minnesota attitude, and that every, you know, they're all look like farm girls, which all look like lesbians. So she is right about that. It's hard to tell. What I really like about it is that she has so many sub stories going on within the story that it keeps you really thinking about a lot of different things. And she, I read this book twice, and even my second time, she had me fooled to the very end. So,
and of course, for those of you that haven't read it, we're not going to do spoilers. No spoilers here.
No, I'm not going to give a spoiler. But I thought I knew who it was at the beginning, and then she fooled me again, even after I'd already read it.
Same here. And Laura, you and I were talking. You were kind of fooled, too.
Yeah, I thought I knew about a third of the way in, and then it changed, and then it changed again, and I was really surprised at the end.
What about you, Beth?
Yeah, I just knew, like, 6 or 7 times, so I kept having these aha moments, and I would say, oh, yeah, so that's who it is, and then every single time I was wrong and thwarted again, so it was really fun.
I read in a blog, Omnivore Bibliosaur, which I think is just a great name for a blog. Ellen, you are a grandmaster from the Mystery Writers of America, a huge honor. This writer talked about grandmasters in chess, and in writing. And she said both require plotting several moves ahead, taking into account as many outcomes as possible. As a new piece of potentially vital intel comes into play in the story, I mentally moved another chess piece ahead. Sometimes a piece was removed from play. Other times a piece made an unexpected move. He did what? She spoke with whom? And I want to ask, when you write, are those moves all in your head from the very beginning, or do they evolve?
Well, you know, I think that's very interesting. I had never heard that about chess, you know, comparing it to chess. For me, I mean, I think, no, they're not in my head to begin with. I come to a book very much the way a reader comes to the book. I learn, you know, in the first 50 pages, a writer should establish who the main characters are, what their relationship is to each other, the main, in a mystery novel, the crime, the hook chapter, which is, you know, designed to get you interested in the story immediately and then pull you into the book. But beyond that, I don't know what's going to happen in every chapter. I mean, I understand the flow of the book, but I respond to what happens. And it's very much like a chess match. I don't know what, you know, if I'm playing chess, say with my grandson, I don't know what he's going to do. But what he does then has an impact on what I do, and that, for me, is very much the way I plot. I see where the characters are going and what they do and how they behave, and things come up during the book which change where I might want to take the story. It is very much like a chess match.
That is fascinating to me. I read that and I thought, I think there's some truth from authors I've talked to. Not sure. Some, they refer to them as pansters and others as plotters.
Yeah.
But I think in my head, if I were to write, I would be halfway in between.
Yeah.
Do you have in your head all of the characters when you begin?
Yes. Before I can begin a book, I need to know a few things. I need to know what the central crime is. I need to know, I cast the book around that crime. I cast the characters in relation to that crime. You know, you need the right characters to tell a story. And once I know that, I can pretty much begin. I may know a few of the chapters ahead. I try and write a running tab, like I know what I want to happen in chapter 2 through chapter 4. I may not be able to see past chapter 4, but being able to see the first 3-4 chapters, it's like headlights on a road. They don't necessarily light the way all the way to where you're going to go at night, but they keep you on the road, and that's what the function is of those chapters that I can see ahead.
Do you have somebody that goes back and checks the facts for you, that once you get going and you've established a character and they've done something, and then you got to remember what they did in a chapter previously? How do you keep track of that?
You know, I mean, by the time you're finished with a book, you know, I've probably gone through that book 10 or 12 times. You know the book very well. Once you've written it, a first draft, that's just the beginning. You then go back, and what you're trying to do is make the characters consistent with what you've learned about them while you wrote the book. And you're trying to make sure that you've got exactly what you mentioned, that everything is right, that everything is consistent. And then you turn it in, and it goes through another couple of editing processes where editors and copy editors look at it, and then you get the galleys back. It's a long, long process to write a book.
Beth, I want to ask you, because you're an author also, how much of this is familiar to you?
So much of it is. I know exactly. I mean, I definitely start with an outline, and I try to know what the ending of the book is going to be. I can't imagine writing just with how complicated my outlines can get for a romance, how difficult a mystery would be with all of the clues dropped and the little hints and the coming around to the ultimate conclusion. I think the process is a lot the same, but I can't imagine the complication of having that be a mystery. And I wondered if I could ask Ellen a question about that.
Go right ahead.
Absolutely. Sure.
Do you ever have someone in mind that's going to be the ultimate villain and then fall in love with them while you're writing it and decide that you can't make that person the bad guy or girl?
I'm not sure. I have, you know, fallen in love with characters. Early on in one of my books, I had a character who was the bad guy in the book. And through the process of the book, I felt like I really got to know him. And I cared about him. And I rewrote that book, I can't remember how many times. And every time I got to the end, and I will say he died at the end, it would upset me so much. They had to get up and go for a walk. I mean, I feel very, very close to these characters. I think really if you don't love them to some extent, they don't let you in. You can't really understand them. And I don't think you're working with human motivation unless you're working with a complete sociopath or a psychopath, someone who's off the scale or mentally ill. You're working with the same motivations we all have, and they should be recognizable to you and to the readers. And because of that, I think you do have to understand them. People do bad things. They may do it for reasons, or they will do it for reasons that we, if you're writing the book well, that you understand. Does that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely.
And okay. Laura, you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, I had a couple questions. One was, okay, so as you're progressing through your writing, about how far through the book have you decided who it's going to be? I mean, do you have that aha moment at, you know, halfway through, or how do you get to that point?
Sure. I usually know, that's one of the things that I usually know at the very beginning. And there's one book where I didn't know, and it drove me nuts writing that book. I had a friend in Chicago, she was writing a book, and she wrote in such a way that she didn't necessarily know who it was until towards the end of the book, and she got to the end of the book and no one had done it. And so she lined all her characters up and said, okay, who did it? None of them had done it. And so she had to write a new person into the book. Now, if I had to do that, I long ago would have stopped writing. So for me, you know, that's one of the important issues. How we get there, how I have my sleuth figure it out, all the clues along the way, that I don't know, but I generally do know who did it and why.
Okay. And then my second question was, have you ever come to a point where you realize that one of your characters could easily have a spinoff book of their own? Because I found one of those in this book that I was dying to know the rest of the story.
Oh, sure. I think that's exciting. I mean, if that happens, I think you should just run with it.
I do have another question, and that is, I love historical novels. I love the historical aspects to this book. The fact that the mystery part of it revolve around what is found at this historic theater. Did you do actual research going to a theater?
Yeah, I did a lot of research online. I found a theater, I think it was somewhere in Ohio, that I used as it was an old opera house that I took the sort of physical setting for. But the rest of it is just what came to me as I was writing the book. One of the weird things in writing this book was I had this idea of what the theater looked like. I mean, I knew exactly what I wanted the theater, and that's what I wrote. It was this building and had one large window, sort of rounded window, and that was over this marquee that had been slapped on later and that built in a long time ago, and then in the 60s they put this marquee on it. And somewhere along the line next to this building, they had built a new building, which now is old, but it was a newer building, where they staffed the people who worked the theater. And when I got, and I had not sent any of this to my publisher, and when I got the first sketches for the book cover, there it was. It was the weirdest thing. It was exactly what I had written and what I was thinking. And here this artist who'd never seen any of it created it. It was just bizarre.
It's wonderful when that happens.
And yeah.
I'm going to ask Beth here, what was the signal entry point for you with this book? Was it character? Was it dialogue? Was it the theater? Was it the family? What?
It was definitely the characters, although speaking of the description, I just wanted to say there was at no point in this book that I thought, oh, here she is describing again. And yet I still felt like I could walk into that place. And I'm not going to mention the characters' names because it is possibly spoils, but there's a scene where two of the characters are watching the curtain. And I felt it. I felt I was there. So even though I don't see myself as being more of, you know, like a description and setting person, I really felt that I could feel the theater. But it was the characterization that really got me. I love the people. I love the family. There was a line where Alan wrote, listening at doors was a venerated dear family sport. And I thought that just described the family so perfectly in one line. You knew so much about them from just that one line.
Linda? Well, I'm always interested in the relationship between Jane and Cordelia and how that came about. And they're so different, and one's really flamboyant and one's kind of reserved. And do you have a friend like Cordelia? Is that...
I do, yeah. Very much like Cordelia. I mean, Cordelia is not her, but they're very close physically, and they look a lot alike. And they're both kind of outrageous and very theatrical and fun. Cordelia has taken on a life of her own, but years ago, when I used to do a lot of book events locally, she would walk in, and people would turn around and go, is that Cordelia? It was really fun.
I want to thank you, Ellen, for putting a glossary at the beginning of characters, list. Because when I read Anne McMahon's back cast, I kept going back to it. Now, who was that? Who was that? And there was some of that in this book. I'm like, okay, are those the two sisters? Is that the brother and sister? Is that the brother of Jane? And so thank you so much from a reader.
That's nice to know. The writer, Niall Marsh, she did that. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. And the reason I did it was because when I would read mysteries, you want, as a writer, you would like to think that your mysteries are read really quickly, all in one setting or a couple of settings, and you know, nobody's ever going to forget who the characters are. Well, that isn't the way our lives work. And so there could be days or weeks or whatever between when you picked up the book and when you pick it up the next time. And for me, what that meant was I could never remember who was who. So I would start jotting down in the back of the book who was who so that I could remember quickly and then get back into the story.
Well, it's great that you give a description, because then when you're reading the story, you can kind of picture them and feel like you're part of it. I'd love that part of it.
I'm glad to hear that.
I want to ask you, Ellen, I'm in awe that this is a series of 22 books. How do you sustain a series for that long and keep it fresh? And this book did seem fresh to me.
Well, oh gosh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's one foot in front of the other. It is extremely difficult to sustain a career. And I wrote 8 books in another series, which was actually something that worked well for me because I would move between series. And that, for a time when I was doing that, for the 10 years probably I was doing that, I was moving back and forth between sets of friends. And I think that helped keep the writing fresh. Another thing I think that helped keep writing fresh was I was dropped by a press, my first publisher, Seal Press, in Seattle. And there was a period of a couple of years when I didn't think that we were going to be able to find a publisher. In New York, we had editors saying, yes, we'd like her writing if she'd write something else, but we're not interested in picking up a series where another press owns the first, you know, 5 or 6 books in that series. And during that 2-year period, I really mourned those characters. I thought, well, maybe I'm done with them. But in that mourning period, I think I thought more deeply about them. And so when I did get another contract from, this time from St. Martin's Minotaur, I felt like I knew them better, and I felt like the texture of the books had changed. That was another thing. And it's also, you know, I don't know anybody. I mean, it's terribly difficult to stay published. It's maybe harder to stay published than it is to get published for multiple reasons. But it's like going hat in hand every 2 years to your employer and saying, are you going to employ me again? At least, you know, working through a New York publisher. So for many years, you know, I was expecting to be dropped. Every 2 years, I was like, well, is this the end? And thankfully, it never was. I had some great backing and great, wonderful editors who really loved what I was doing. But even so, I think being scared all the time makes you feel like, well, you've got to do your absolute best. You can't let down.
I know many authors who are by nature an introvert, but being published, whether independently or through a publisher, they feel as if they have to be salespeople.
Yeah.
It's not real comfortable because personality dictates otherwise.
I think all artists of any nature, be it songwriter or painter or whatever, they have to sell themselves, and that's really the hardest part of their job, is to sell themselves.
Yep.
And I have another question, and I will ask each of you. Agatha Christie wrote in her autobiography about her dislike of mysteries having a romantic subplot, and yet many lesbian fiction readers demand romance. So I thought, Ellen, you walked this line beautifully. I want to know, are there Jane Lawless books that have more of the relationship between Jane and her girlfriend or...
Girlfriends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you,
well,
Linda.
there have been books. Here's my feeling about that. You could write a mystery that, you know, fairly tight mystery, but the romantic aspects of it can give you fit. You know, I mean, that can be sometimes some of the most difficult things going on. I agree to an extent with Agatha Christie, although I think romantic mysteries and romantic suspense are certain. I mean, I don't know if she was digging at Dorothy L. Sayers there or what, but I think romance has always been a part of that. You had the American hard-boiled kind of mystery where there was sex, but there really wasn't any relationship, and then, which I'm not particularly interested in. I've never been all that interested in writing a specifically romantic mystery. Here's the deal. Modern mysteries are very character-driven, and because of that, you have to give your readers a somewhat rounded character to the degree that you can and to the degree that the book allows. To do that, they have to have a personal life. And so P.D. James handled that by giving her main character a wife who died. And that was it. That was it. He, you know, was sad and would think about her. But then she didn't have to deal with that aspect in her crime novels. I have felt compelled to give Jane the most rounded life that I can with a family and with a brother and with a friends, that sort of thing. And, of course, you know, she had a partner who also died, but she's still alive. And so she got lucky first time around. She hasn't been so lucky since. I've kept a character, a recurring character named Julia through the book, who has not always been a good person.
No.
But in the book that I'm working on now, which is called A Whisper of Bones, we come full circle with Julia. So there's a fairly significant subplot.
A teaser heard only here.
A teaser, yeah.
Interesting.
And one of the other books where I thought to me had some of the most emotional resonance in that way was a book called The Iron Girl, which is one of my favorite books in the series, where we actually go back. It's kind of a prequel. It's set in the now, but we go back in that book to see Jane and her first partner, Christine, and what happened to them. And that was really fun to write.
And Beth, do you have any reaction to this?
I think that you, like Ellen said, she has a well-rounded character. You can't have your character live in a vacuum. And so unless you have some reason why she wouldn't be dating or wouldn't be interested in trying to deal with relationships, just as, you know, she's bad at feeding herself healthy meals and talks to her dogs and cares about her father, she also deals with relationship issues. And I never at any time felt that this was romance that was thrown into the book so there could be a romantic interest. It just felt like an offset or an offshoot of Jane's life.
Good. Thank you.
I've been thinking about this question. Like in a dream, every character that you dream is a piece of you. So in the book, is every character a piece of you?
I think so. I think to a certain extent. Well, I think a writer to a certain extent is like an actor. You have to get inside all these characters and you have to flesh them out inside you before you can write them. That doesn't happen necessarily before you write the book, but it certainly happens as you write the book. And as I said, that's what a lot of revisions are, is just going back and making those characters consistent with what you've learned about them as you've written the book. But yeah, I think that's why people who have spent some time in personal examination, self-examination, and I think writers are naturally like this. I think they are quieter. They tend to do a lot of watching and listening. And I think you're right about that introverted part of a creative person's character is there, and it makes you sort of a watcher, and it makes you into the kind of person who's asking, well, why is this happening? And I think, you know, the more you do that, the more you're able to bring to your characters, because the more you see what it is to be human.
So why is it that there's so many dead bodies around Jane Lawless?
Isn't that just awful? I wouldn't want to know her.
Is she related to Jessica Fletcher in Cabot Cove?
I know. You know, that's just, it's Jessica's coming to dinner, and, you know, so, well, I won't be. Everybody's dropping around her like flies. That's just part of the suspension of disbelief that you have to, you know, have to go with when you're reading a mystery.
At this point, Ellen, this might be interesting for you. I've asked Laura and Beth, and Linda was busy doing a show, so I don't think she had a chance, to read a favorite passage from the book, just a few lines. And I suspect each of us will have something different. So,
I'd have to read the whole book.
nice one, Linda. She's fast on her feet. Laura, yeah. I'm going to ask you.
Easing down on all fours, Jane began running her flashlight beam across the cracks in the floorboards. She was almost done when she found something odd. Scooting over to her messenger bag, she removed a pair of tweezers, then moved back and carefully eased a folded piece of paper out of the crack. Holding the flashlight in her mouth, she opened it. When she saw what it was, she felt a pure adrenaline rush. It took a few more seconds for the dread to set in.
And mine is related, interestingly enough. It's not. It's from a completely different part of the book. Wow, that is one big bar, said Jane. It must have been 20 feet long, covered in the dust of decades, but with the deco design features still visible in the carved oak. Look at that, said Cordelia, pointing to a row of bullet holes that began at the far end and moved toward them. Her high heels clicked against the black and white floor tiles as she moved behind the bar and pointed to the shattered mirror shelving that once upon a time had probably held the liquor bottles. More bullet holes.
That was my second favorite passage, actually.
Beth, what have you got?
I think it's cute. It shows what appeals to all of us, because, you know, I love great characters. So I had Jane sat in front of the fireplace in her living room, feeling warm for the first time all day. As the fire snapped and the birch log shifted in the grate, she ate her dinner, a bowl of buttered popcorn. Her dogs had hunkered down next to her, their eyes moving in lockstep with her hand back and forth as she lifted the popcorn from the bowl to her mouth. It must be like watching a tennis match, she thought to herself, except that in this case, the ball was edible.
And what person with the dog hasn't experienced that?
Yeah. Exactly. That says so much about her. She sits there and eats popcorn for dinner and talks to her dogs. I think that's such a beautiful, it's so relatable to me. I've done that.
Yep, me too.
And well, I really like Cordelia when she starts talking, and she's so flamboyant. And then it surprised me that she likes her niece, and she's so attached to her. It's not, she doesn't play a big part in this book, but she has in others. But I really like that finally Cordelia has something that she can really be attached to and be responsible for, because she seems like an irresponsible person.
And a person who hated children and she fell in love with one. I thought it was a very interesting, as opposed to having a love interest, having a child was kind of very rich to pull from some of that.
Yeah, I like that.
And Ellen, you had mentioned The Iron Girl, and you chose The Deep and the Dark. If someone wants to know more about Cordelia and Jane, is there a book from the series that you would recommend? And is there one? I know that they're all your babies, they're all your children, but is there one that you're particularly fond of from the early days?
From the early days? Yeah, probably a book called A Small Sacrifice. That book is about friendship. And I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I always loved that book. And if you want to read a book where there's a little bit about Cordelia's history, I wrote a book called A Merchant of Venus.
Yes.
And that goes into kind of her background and her sister's background, and would give you some foundation for her and the stories about her.
Thank you. Laura, you had a question?
So I kind of have this really OCD thing where if I jump into the middle of something, I've got to go back from the beginning. Back to the beginning and go forward. So I just started reading Hallowed Murder. Do you have a sorority background?
No, but when I was writing it, I was working at a sorority.
Oh, okay.
And so that's where I set it. There used to be something called a Take Back the Night March here, at least there was in Minneapolis, and it was where women would march to, we would march down the main street of downtown Minneapolis to take the streets back for women at night, and it was a really big deal. And when I was at a march, I think I captained the march with my partner that year. There was a young woman there, and I knew her from the sorority where I was working. And she had on a lavender armband, which said to me, well, she was a lesbian. And I thought, well, I know she's not out at the sorority. And then I started thinking, well, what must that be like? Because a sorority by nature is a very heterosexual place. You know, one sorority will do something with a fraternity. I mean, I couldn't imagine that. And so just in thinking about her, the story for Hallowed Murder was sort of evolved from that.
That's neat. I really am enjoying it so far, but I was just curious. And I've also noticed somewhat of a maturing between Jane back then to the Jane in The Old Deep and Dark, which I think is interesting.
I hope so. That's 30 years ago.
I know. but it's, she hasn't
Very
aged
history.
30 years, though. That's the cool part.
Yeah.
I have a question for our two authors, and I'll start with you, Beth. Ellen mentioned that she's been a chef and that she was working at a sorority. What parts of your life have found their way into your books?
The book that I just sent off to my beta readers, one of the women worked in directory assistance, and I did work for a very short time in directory assistance, which, oddly enough, more people call and do porn calls, like, you know, those obscene phone callers to directory assistance than you would imagine. I don't know why they pay $1.99 to call directory assistance and say obscene things and get hung up on, but that happens a lot. So that's come into one of my books.
And Ellen, you mentioned working at a sorority and being a chef. What else have you done that has found its way into your books?
That's kind of an open question.
Intentionally so.
Well, you know, places I go, characters, very often people I found that kind of drive me nuts, I will put in a book. My mother found, of course, her way into my books a lot, although she never saw herself in my books.
Well, I think it's wonderful that travel finds its way into your books. What are some of the more exotic settings?
Wisconsin.
I'm going to say, where have you, what books are you reading? Because she doesn't travel.
Well, I love Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, there, you know, things like that. But Connecticut was where I set a book, and I loved Connecticut when I was there. England as a backdrop to Jane's own personal story. And I think, you know, as I mentioned before, as a writer, I think, and Beth, I'm sure, can speak to this too, you know, you're always just looking around. You're looking at things. You're looking to see what you can use. I mean, if you know a writer and you think they're watching you, they are.
That's true.
I used to edit comic strips for a national and international syndication, and I would say something to a cartoonist and then find 2 weeks later, wait, I didn't think that'd be in the comic strip. I've learned to beware of all kinds of writers.
Yeah.
Well, one question that I have, and I don't believe we've touched on yet, is this was, no details, but this was a very, very dysfunctional family. Did you enjoy writing the dysfunction?
That's primarily what I like to write about, is I like to write about families because I'm dealing with, most of the time I've been writing this series, I've been dealing with an amateur sleuth, someone who has no ability to walk up to somebody and say, you have to tell me this. She's not a law enforcement officer. She's not a lawyer. I think the natural bailiwick of an amateur sleuth is family issues, because families, as a character, you can get them to open up to you in the way that the police never would. You have access to things that the police never would, and I'm interested in families because I think, you know, that comment, I don't know who made it, that everybody's happy in the same way, but people are all unhappy in very individual ways. I think dysfunctional families are just such I don't mean to use the word easy, but you can mine them. I mean, there's just so much going on, secrets and history, and to me, that is just the stuff of a mystery.
Linda?
Well, I was always thinking that Jane always seems to take the high moral road, and every now and then she doesn't, and that kind of is a surprise, but it's kind of interesting. She's not boring, even though that she takes the high road, and she's moral, and she's always trying to help people, and there always seems to be some kind of a good moral story to it overall, and I like that. It's reassuring that there's still people who believe in helping others. And
it's one of the things, if I may say, just to interject, that I love about mystery novels is that, you know, when you come to a mystery novel, that you're coming to a world in chaos. There's usually been a murder or some really terrible happening, but you know, the way a child knows when they're being read a fairy tale by their, or a story by their parents, that when you come to the end of that story, it's going to be somewhat comforting, or it's, there's going to be an ending that does comfort you. So in a way, I think mystery novels give you what CNN can't. They give you resolution. You don't
yes.
necessarily move from sadness to happiness, but you move from chaos to some kind of order and hopefully some justice.
Beth, you mentioned, I believe to me, that you like to read romances. And in romances, there's conflict, and then it's resolved, usually, with a happy ending. Probably not quite so much death as in mysteries.
So, you hope.
Beth, any reactions or comments?
I just felt the Deer family was definitely dysfunctional, but they weren't outrageously dysfunctional. As I think it was Laura just said, they were at their worst. This is a tragedy, and this is everybody at their worst, and everyone behaving badly, and everybody trying to deal with family that they've had these strained relationships with. And so they were dysfunctional, but I don't know if this speaks to my own family or friends, but I didn't find any of their dysfunction to be so dysfunctional as to be unbelievable. I thought that even the ones that were behaving really badly kind of felt that, at least in their hearts, that they had reasons to behave in that way.
There were a couple of characters, Beth, that if I met them in real life, I would run away.
Absolutely. I think what Beth said is true. You know, a mystery novel takes place during a crisis, and you would hate to be judged by the worst thing you ever did in your life, and that usually would come at a time like that.
It's true. That is a very original point I hadn't thought of. Laura?
I thought it was endearing that Chloe and Booker were really closer than you might have anticipated. I thought that was nice, and he was there for his sister. Those kids were the ones I was referring to as I'd like to know the rest of their
story.
Who I
thought the sorry was for.
Yeah.
They had a heart.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ellen, I have a question. Have you ever considered writing in another genre, or are you mystery to the core?
I actually have a book that I've been sort of picking at for years, and I think I don't really know if it would in the end be considered a mystery. There are mystery elements. It would be if it would be considered a thriller, because there are suspense elements, or if it would be considered a romance, because there are those. It could be an allegory. I honestly don't know what it is. It's kind of a hybrid, but it's a story that has been, you know, knocking on the door for so many years. I have written some of it, and hopefully, before I die, I will get a chance to actually spend some time with it and see what I can make out of it.
I'm intrigued. I would love to read that one. I want to ask you, because it was in late April that you traveled to New York City and were named Grand Master of the Mystery Writers of America. Could you tell a little about that evening and what it meant to you?
Oh, it was just amazing. The Grand Master Award is sort of the pinnacle of achievement in the mystery field. Other people like, Stephen King, Agatha Christie, Alfred Hitchcock, Graham Greene, P.D. James, who, you know, I consider a mentor. People that, I used to read that list and I would think, wow, they're not, first of all, I would look at it and I would think, well, there aren't enough women on this list. But secondly, I would think, you know, those are the people that made me want to write. And then to have, and then to be put on that list is, it's just mind-blowing. The whole situation was mind-blowing. I had my publisher come up to me after I gave the speech and say how honored he was that, and he really meant it because he just grabbing my hand, that he could publish me. I mean, I've always felt that I've been writing in the shadows, and I didn't think anybody noticed, really. So, and it was also the first time, and I think this is extremely important, that a lesbian or gay or lesbian writer, LGBT writer, has ever been honored with that award. And I don't know why they picked me, but I'll take it. And way, I think, you know, we broke the lavender ceiling with that award.
Congratulations.
And I love the introduction. The whole video was just wonderful. And
Jean's introduction?
Yes.
Yeah, she was great. Yeah.
So now you don't have to worry about renewing your contract every 2 years, right?
I guess maybe not, but who knows? It is publishing.
We're running out of time, so I want to ask you how someone could contact you or find you.
Sure. Well, I'm on Facebook. Just friend me on Facebook. I have a website. It's www.ellenhart.com, and you can click on the link, which will give you my email there, but I can also tell you my email. It's ellenhart@earthlink.net.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to hear from anybody.
Thank you so much for joining us.